Well, welcome to our continuing journey through Ezekiel in Breakfast with Jesus. In the last talk, I summarised Stendhal's thesis, and that was a little bit of an excursion from Ezekiel. In other words, his thesis is that the way that we typically frame the gospel is narrow and modernistic. That is, we take the problematic situation as being sin, and in particular, the troubled conscience and the individual grappling with sin, and then redemption of Christ is the solution to this problem. The reason I got onto Stendhal was that I'd said that in Ezekiel, the concept of sins doesn't fit that private guilt conception. They're really geopolitical sins, the failure to rule. So in this talk, I want to go back to Ezekiel and develop this image of the glory departing and the glory returning. So to keep on holding the big picture in our minds, chapter one introduces this heavenly layer, this vision of a heavenly layer that frames events on the earth. And I don't think the word glory is mentioned in chapter one, but it is very much implied there because of its connection to chapter 10, when the glory departs, where the living beings depart. And so glory seems to be some field of play, some kind of moral, spiritual, gravitational field that governs the divine human interaction at all times. And Ezekiel is using that to explain what is a circumstantial event in Israel's history. Glory seems to be mediated by the living creatures, and they are somehow the vehicle of God's presence and activity on the earth, and the spirit animates their actions. There's almost a correlation between glory and spirit implied here. Now, as we saw, the glory departs from the temple in chapter 10, but astonishingly returns in chapters 40 to 47, and the return is implied even before that in the Valley of Dry Bones, the resurrection of the Valley of Dry Bones. But it doesn't return, however, to the same temple. It's a new kind of temple that clearly exceeds the range and scope of the old temple. Now, there's no doubt that in the particulars of Ezekiel's situation, the temple in chapter 10 refers to the temple in Jerusalem. It's about to be destroyed. And there's no question that his book, written from the vantage of the exile, is a warning for people not to hang on to a false hope that Jerusalem will continue. It's going to be destroyed. That's clearly anchored in a local situation. But the temple in chapter 40 and following is clearly not the same temple. It's some mystical amplification of that temple. And the scope of blessing of this second temple is no longer nationalistic and local. It seems to fill the whole earth. It seems to be the source of nourishing life. And this life brings life back to all of nature. And that's the wonderful picture. And it's an inexhaustible life. So the question I want to look at in this Breakfast with Jesus talk is, well, what do we make of this story? Is it just the story of the exile? Is that framing of Ezekiel all it is? My point, unsurprisingly, is that this vision is not just a localized vision of Judah's exile and return. It's a vision of salvation. It's a vision of the whole redemptive scale of God's work. So my argument here is that just as the Exodus is the narrative of God's active redemption of all people that was ultimately fulfilled in Jesus, not just Moses. In the same way, the exile echoes and reprises both the Exodus event, but like the Exodus event, it is a type of the ultimate redemption of all mankind. So Ezekiel's visionary interpretation of the exile, which he sees as the reality that's determining the exile, is in fact an exalted vision of the whole arc of God's redemptive work. So with that in mind, what can we learn from it? Well, very, very simply, glory departing and returning is a way better way to frame the gospel than the traditional sin forgiveness schematic. It's way better as an announcement, as a declaration. I mean, typically, we Christians tend to think the gospel begins with the problem has to be defined, the problem is sin. So our message to people of the problematic state of the human condition is humanity is sinful. That's our diagnosis. And for a variety of ways, that's not a great place to start rhetorically. I won't get into whether it's theologically a great place to start. I don't think it is, really, as we unfold it in this talk. That'll become clearer, but certainly not rhetorically, because we've got a modern generation that for whom sin is almost a specialist religious term. It's a term that immediately inspires debate. But to declare the glory has departed is different. It's not just different marginally and semantically, you know, it's just a different paradigm, a different concept. And I think it gives us some very different language to describe what we commonly call the fall and the predicament of the human condition. Now, the language of sin diagnoses the human condition as and problem as a moral problem. But the language of lost glory changes this. It situates the problem far more broadly, and it situates it as primarily a loss of life, a loss of potential, a loss of magnificence. That's the first thing. It's not primarily a moral diagnosis. It's something bigger. It doesn't deny a moral diagnosis, but it actually talks much more about a life diagnosis. And secondly, the traditional language of sin characterizes the human condition as a failure and frames the failure as falling short of some kind of universal moral code. So that's essentially a negative way of framing the problem. But the language of glory is different. It just changes the whole rhetorical situation because it characterizes the human condition in positive terms as the loss of greatness, not just the contravention of some moral code. It doesn't deny there's a moral issue, but it's a subset of a bigger issue, the loss of greatness, the loss of capacity. That's what it implies. The language of sin on its own carries no picture. No picture is intrinsic there of destiny or the calling of humanity. But the language of glory is different. It does suggest a destiny. It does suggest a heritage, and a heritage that could hardly be any higher. Glory is suggesting humanity has some kind of participation in the life of God, in the divine being. So it's a way of changing language that changes paradigms. Let's just give a really simple example of how this works. You take a child who's misbehaving in some way, right? Now, a parent or a teacher or a mentor, they've got a choice of the language you're going to use with that child and how you're going to interpret and communicate that misbehavior to the child. So the moral way is something like this. You have done something wrong. You have contravened some rule. Now, that's negative. That's framing the entire situation against that rule. If you've ever had an argumentative child, you'll know they're liable to challenge the teacher and say, well, quickly, they'll take the conversation into a moral quicksand about, well, which rule? Why should I even obey it anyway? I can remember, you know, very frustrating conversations with some of our teenage children on whether taking drugs was wrong. And you'd get into this moral quicksand of relativity and drugs aren't different to alcohol and you drink, so what's the difference, etc., etc., etc. So in this way, the whole discourse moves to morality. And it ends up allowing a moral code and compliance to the moral code to define what good means. It's just going to take you down that cul-de-sac. Second way you could talk to the child is something like this. Look, you've got a lot of potential and a big future that you're equipped for, But this way of behaving falls short of that potential, and it's going to trap you into some kind of perpetual infancy. You'll never grow up to be who you are in this way. So now the teacher defined the misdemeanor, not according to a moral code, but according to some kind of destiny, some kind of potential. If the child wants to challenge, then the trajectory of the conversation will be, well, what do you mean by that destiny? Spell it out more, make it attractive to me. So the language of glory departing is very much in that second order. And of course, the most cursory reading of the famous Romans 3:23 backs this up. He doesn't say all have sinned. He says all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Rightio. So with that introduction, which is saying there is a rhetorical shift in the language of glory departing, let's dive down and get a little bit deeper into these two big words. The two big words are glory and temple. I might divide it up and make them into two talks. The first thing to say is that glory and temple are working together like a couplet. They're not just independent words. So in essence, they work as a unit. They're giving us a picture of creation. Really importantly, they're giving us a picture of the world we live in, a way of interpreting, a way of framing it. And in particular, they are framing our lived experience in the world in terms of the relationship between God and creation. The glory tabernacle couplet is the system that God has designed. So, as Christians, we have some specialist, revealed wisdom to offer people. This world is not just circumstantial. This world is not just material. We're not on our own floating around as flotsam and jetsam in a vast cosmos, etc., etc., etc. We primarily should not be defining ourselves even by the cultures we live in, although that's important. Is there hope in the world? All those kind of questions are put into a very promising framework by the glory temple framing of this thing we live in called life. Glory, the word glory, describes God's presence in creation. And the word temple renames creation as a sacred space, as primarily God's space, not merely as matter or as some kind of independent entity. It doesn't deny matter, but the whole point of matter is it's a home. It's not just a thing. And in that light, the departing and returning, those verbs, they're symbolic of the whole redemptive story, where the tabernacle is the cosmos, mankind is the custodian in the cosmos, and the glory departing is the life of God withdrawing somehow from the cosmos, from humanity, from the earth. So we have a salvation narrative now that's implied here, departing and returning. It is not about penal guilt. It doesn't imply it. Nothing in the Ezekiel narrative implies that. But it is about the glory departing from humanity. So we're not talking about a darkened view of human nature here, but about a great view of lost potential. And the problem is not primarily guilt and impending condemnation. The problem is a loss of glory. We've lost glory. And that departure of glory spreads to the whole earth and the cosmos. This is a sad story about the life of God evacuating the creation, but then the promise of that glory returning. And the return is important. It's a return that's not a return back to the same that things were before. Actually, if you look at the temple, what really happened in the exile was not even that. In other words, a magnificent structure was destroyed, and then the story of Ezra and Nehemiah, I'm going to do a few talks on next, is actually very anticlimactic. They're just building a shed compared to what was there before. So literally it didn't happen. However, the glory returning in number 47 is the opposite. It's an amplification. The glory that comes back is vastly bigger than the glory that departed. Having begun locally, it returns everywhere. So let's dive down into these two words. They're both very evocative words, temple and glory, and they're words that are pervasive, evocative. I don't want to say complex, but it's more suggestive. It's a complex sounds like this is too complicated, too hard. No. It's suggestive, and it's developed throughout the Bible. Both words are developed throughout the Bible. They're like rods that go from Genesis right through to Revelation, where in general, glory suggests transcendence, and temple suggests meaning in the mundane. Glory gives the temple meaning. Let's start with the temple. This word really reverberates right throughout the whole Bible. A very worthwhile thing to do is to follow the echoes throughout the Bible and the prototypes throughout the Bible. The Bible is clearly using this word everywhere as a metaphor or an image. And better still, it's a synecdoche. You may have heard me talk about synecdoche before. That's a class of metaphor it's a specific class where you use something lesser to refer to something greater. So let's look at some really pertinent points. The first point is that you need to begin with the creation account where the cosmos is seen as a temple. Genesis 1 is very much a temple poem. Rick Watts has written brilliantly about that. It's widely accepted by Jewish and Christian authors that the interpretation behind all of creation is that it is a temple. And that, by the way, that suggestion or thought was not merely Jewish. I think the Jews took it to a very high point, but the ancient Near Eastern world had a similar concept that creation was a microcosmos, a sort of a temple of God, but we get it in its purest form through Moses. Now, I won't go into Genesis 1 and the way Genesis 1 is structured. Rick has given talks on that and also wrote a great article on it called Making Sense of Genesis 1. And the backlogs of gospel conversations, both John Walton and Ian Proven have talked about it magnificently, much more than I could. So you could look at those. But the first thing to say is that when you see the word temple, the primary thing to think about it is about creation as a sacred space. The second thing to say in the Genesis account is humanity is placed in the temple as the image of God. That's important. There's some kind of climaxing of creation in the placing of the image in the temple, and that image is humanity. Now, the function of humanity is to be a ruler in the temple. Now, that's explicit in Genesis 1, but it's implied pretty well everywhere that the image is bringing a kingship idea into the temple. In fact, Rick, in his article, explains that the Hebrew word for palace and temple is the same word. They're used interchangeably. So the word temple is implying some kind of royal functionality. And quoting Rick, Rick says in this article, Yahweh fashions his own image and places it in his palace temple. Another commentator, Stephen Herring, who writes very well about that, moves on to a really important point. We tend in our modern world to have trouble with the word image. I think we've got shallow conceptions of it. We need to go deeper. It's very, very important. And Herring's main point is don't think of the image as just a portrait. The ancient world didn't. It's not standing for something like a portrait, but it's actually manifesting the presence of the God. In other words, it's more an incarnation than a portrait. And another scholar says the reason for steering away from the word portrait should be that word implies a separation of the sitter and the portrait. The portrait's a thing, and then there's the sitter. The portrait is a copy of the real person, but image has the potential of actually becoming an entity in its own right, a being rather than a copy of a being. So it's animated, it's living, it's actually carrying something of the artist into the world. And then the function of that imaging is it's not there merely to be representative, it is to deploy rule on behalf of the deity, to deploy rule into that atmosphere on behalf of the deity. So, to sum that point up for us, the image language, whenever you read it, it entails kingship. It's implying kingship. not just representation, but kingship. It is incarnation of a divine being and kingship. So that's Genesis 1. Genesis 1 is used throughout the rest of the scriptures, the Old Testament in particular, as a storehouse of motifs that can govern things. And the next large part of the Torah that develops the creational narrative is Exodus 25 to 40. Now, that describes the tabernacle, which became the temple, being constructed. Importantly, it's echoing the creation account. So the tabernacle slash temple, it's not seen as some kind of religious refuge, like, you know, going to church, where people retreat from the wide world. It's into some kind of hermetically sealed religious ritualistic space. But it almost works the other way around. It goes out. It goes out and it reframes all of life, social, political, geographical, cosmic, as a temple, as a sacred space. It is offered as a microcosmos, and it's suggesting an incarnational nature of the creation. Quite complex layers that seem to be intertwining the divine order and the created order. Clearly, the idea of Ezekiel's vision of the glory departing from the temple is the glory departing from the created order, some withdrawal of that incarnational presence in creation. Some scholars have gone quite deep into this. Peter Kearney wrote an article where he specifically sees the days of creation mirrored in Exodus 25 to 40. In other words, he sees Exodus 25 to 40 as deliberately structured according to the same sequence of the 6 days of creation. I won't go into his argument, but it's certainly evocative. And so he sees deliberate echoes of language where Exodus 25 to 40 is picking up on Genesis 1. He's seeing a correspondence, therefore, between the world being created and the temple being created. And in this schema, Aaron, the priest, is imitating God as reenacting creation. His high priestly role is to be a creator of the structures of not just the temple, but of the micro, of the cosmos. So, for instance, Exodus 27:20, Aaron's first job is lighting the candles and keeping light going throughout the night. So Kearney sees that as echoing day one. God said, let there be light. So he's seeing that echo going on. The really interesting one where people do see quite a strong echo is not just Aaron, but Bezalel, who is the architect and designer of the temple. Now, Bezalel's interesting because he's a designer. He's the first person in the Bible to be said to be filled with the Holy Spirit, which clearly is an echo of Genesis 2:7, where the Spirit is breathed into Adam. So there's a very strong echo here that Bezalel is not just an incidental character who happened to make the curtains of the temple. He's a picture of humanity in God's microcosmos. He's given the attributes of God in his task, wisdom, skills, and so on. And his task is to design and build the temple. He's the shape-shifter of created materials, using created materials to bring glory to God. As someone wrote, Bezalel's creation of the tabernacle is tantamount to God's creation of the universe. So we are now seeing in Bezalel humanity as image, as ruler, as shape shifter of the cosmos, fashioning it according to beauty to reflect the glory of God. The name itself is interesting. Bezalel's name, it's often taken to mean in the shadow of God, in the Hebrew meaning that, but one scholar, Friedman, has argued that it goes further. It intimates the image of God from the creation story. He says Bezalel was filled with the Spirit of God, which, as I've just said, also comes from the creation story. And he was the great artist of the Torah. He was the creative one who fashions the tabernacle and its contents. And Friedman ends with a great statement that I thoroughly agree with. Being creative is the ultimate imitation of God. So the picture we've got is all of nature, all of social systems, all of our world is sacred space, but equally coordinating with that and utterly integrated with it is the role of humanity as king, shapeshifter, image of God in the creation. So in this way, tabernacle and humanity converge. You don't see one without the other. They're both dwelling places for the divine being. The tabernacle is seen as sacred and the dwelling place of God, and that helps us see creation as a tabernacle. And humanity is seen both as part of that dwelling place, a microcosmos, and a talisman, a representative of God as the creator of that dwelling place, almost as if God has created the cosmos with potentiality, which we are to shape and continue the creative effort in. So we're looking at two acts of creation. We're looking at an original act and then a sub-creative act where Bezalel is walking in the footsteps of the creator as he fashions the temple. We're getting a really, really rich picture here of what this word temple means in the Christian mind, in the revealed mind. It is telling us that creation is sacred, sacred space, but it is also very much implying humanity's role in that sacred space. And this is the tabernacle from which glory has departed. We can create a picture, a very inspiring picture of the problematic situation of humanity as having dropped the ball of sub-creation and transformation, and therefore the glory departing is a withdrawal of the fullness of that potentiality and that glory. And so we see through a glass darkly. We don't see creation as sacred naturally. We need to work on that. We need that to be revealed to us. We junk creation. We don't treasure creation. We get bored with things. We ask God to show himself to us when we're living in his tabernacle. So all of that is implied in this really magnificent image of the temple / tabernacle. So I think it's a smart thing to take a break there and let you absorb some of that, as I've had to absorb it. I'll add another talk on glory in the next few days.